I'm interviewing Ellen Parks at her home on Lake McDonald in northwestern Montana. Ellen, when and where were you born?
I was born in Washington, D.C. in 1920. And my dad was in the Navy, and he had been in Europe and had stayed in Europe. My mother went over and met him right after World War I, and he won the French Legion of Honor for his work after the war was over. And mother came home to have me in Washington, D.C. And then right as soon as I was born, about, say, 6 weeks later, my dad was transferred to the Philippine Islands, and we went to the Philippines on the boat. And I don't remember terribly much about the Philippines, except my ama, my nanny, and the typhoon, which they did me up in a blanket like Cleopatra, rolled me up in a rug, and carried me out in the middle of the typhoon. And then coming
back... Why did they carry you out in the middle of the typhoon?
Well, yes, there was a typhoon, and I don't remember it. I just remember being rolled up in the rug.
Well, why did they carry you out in the middle of it?
Well, because they wanted to get us out. They're afraid the house was going to blow down.
Oh, I see.
And they were taking us to safer quarters.
I see.
And then we came back to the States in 1924, and my little sister was born in Washington, D.C.
And now, your mother was the daughter of Senator Thomas Walsh from Montana.
Mm-hmm, right. She was Genevieve Walsh Gudger. And she really was his only child. And when my grandmother died, when my mother was maybe 25 or 26, and so my mother became my grandfather's hostess and general lady that went to all the parties with him and that sort of thing.
And that was the case in the 1920s,
Yes, 1920 and in the 20s. And well, no, because my dad got transferred to Norfolk, Virginia, and my mother used to go up if there was a big affair. She'd go up to go with my grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a bachelor or...
widower.
Widower, yes, right, until he married Mina de Parmont from Havana, Cuba, and he married her in 1933.
So you knew him from the time you were a little girl until his death.
Yes.
In 1913.
Oh yes, and we lived with him in Washington, D.C. in an apartment, and two apartments, two different ones that I remember.
How would you describe him?
Very stern and very lacking a sense of humor, and not at all a games person or something like that. He was an intellectual, and he didn't really understand little girls that weren't intellectuals too.
Did he read a lot?
He read a lot, but also, and he had one of those photographic memories, I'm sure, when looking back on it, he could read something and just remember it just like that. And he used to take me with him when he had a special party to go to and that sort of thing, and he took me to the White House for the Easter egg rolling. And that's where I knocked Mrs. Coolidge off her feet.
Well, tell that story.
Well, what happened, I was about six or seven, and I had new shoes. And they have an Easter egg roll in at the White House, which I think they still have it to this day. And we'd come in the front door, and there were stairs going down to go out into the gardens in the back. And my feet went out from under me at age seven, and I went tumbling down the stairs, Easter eggs all over the place, of course, and knocked Mrs. Coolidge, I think it was Mrs. Coolidge before Mrs. Hoover.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Mrs. Coolidge off her feet, her Easter eggs all over the place. And my grandfather was absolutely mortified. Mortified. And I remember another time that I absolutely mortified him, too, was Daisy Harriman, who was Averill Harriman's mother, was crazy about him. Came out here two times to woo him.
Here at Lake McDonald.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And she stayed down at the big house, but she he wasn't interested in her, I guess, or something. But she invited me, to the birthday party or Christmas party of her daughter, who was my age. And I went with my grandfather, took me. And I'd always wanted a dollhouse, and underneath the tree in the ballroom of Mrs. Harriman's house was this beautiful dollhouse. And I said, oh, look, Santa's brought me a dollhouse, and my grandfather's trying to shut me up, of course, for in the dollhouse, and that it wasn't mine, it would belong to her daughter, you know, and so on and so forth. And I was in tears about not getting the dollhouse. And the next day, there was the dollhouse at our house. Oh, she had my. Sent me the dollhouse. And it was this fabulous dollhouse with all the electricity in it and everything else like that. It was a wonderful dollhouse.
What became of it, do you know?
I don't know. It's gone. I don't know. But I remember I embarrassed him terribly. And but always, my father was in the Navy, and my father was always very sociable as far as everybody was concerned, and he loved to play cards, and he taught me to play bridge and things like that. He taught me all the games I knew and everything. My grandfather never. He was very stern, and his idea of teaching me was to get me down and make me read Greek history. And I can remember thinking, I can't pronounce that word. And he said, do it by syllables, you know. And but anyway, he was teaching me Greek history.
The Peloponnesian Wars and things
yes,
like that?
Yes, things like that, yeah. And the gods and goddesses and all like that, which really interests a seven-year-old.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, he was a short man. My dad was short, too, but he was short. My mother was short. He wasn't a tall man. I think he was probably 5'4", maybe.
Quite short.
Yeah. And the interesting thing... he was from Wisconsin originally, and there were four boys and three girls, I believe, in the family. And the youngest boy ran away with the circus, and he ended up in California. And my grandfather, every time he tried a case, would look for him, and finally found him in Portland, Oregon. And he'd gone out there, and he had became a lumberman. And my grandfather gave him the keys to this big house.
Here on Lake McDonald.
Yes, uh-huh. And my grandmother could always tell if he'd been here because things weren't put back exactly like she had put them back. And my mother kept up with him for years. And when I got married to Jim, she sent him a wedding invitation. And he sent me a wedding present. And the wedding present was heather that he had picked in the hills to put in my sheets so that my sheets would smell good. Wasn't that sweet? Anyway, he died out after my grandfather, and he died out in Portland, Oregon, and Mother sent for him, and he's buried next to my grandfather in Helena.
But you never actually saw him or
never
Betty?
Saw him. I never saw him.
Yeah.
And the second boy was a lawyer. My grandfather was a lawyer. The second boy was a lawyer in South Dakota, and when Montana became a state, they moved over here. The second boy didn't. He died before he moved over here. And then the third one was a lawyer in Washington, D.C., and he practiced law the whole time my grandfather was there in Washington.
Do you remember him?
Oh, very well. Yes, more than I do my grandfather, because he didn't die till I was maybe 23 or 24, and my grandfather died when I was 13.
Did you? I think you mentioned to me once before, before this interview, that Senator Walsh had taken you around Washington as a little girl. He had shown
you
some
always.
Of the sights of Washington
yes,
and that sort
and
of thing.
Yes, I remember one particular time that he took me around Washington. He used to walk. And he used to have a cane, and the cane was just decoration. He didn't need the cane, but he would just, you know, walk along with his cane. And once he took me to the Mayflower Hotel, which is the big, expensive hotel there on Pennsylvania Avenue. And in the lobby, all the reporters were around a couch in the lobby. And my grandfather almost got me bald-headed to get me out of there in a hurry because I was so interested in what was going on and everything. It was Huey Long, and Huey Long was lying on the sofa dead drunk doing an interview. And my grandfather didn't want me to see that. That was not right for me to see that. And I remember particularly up here, he was very stern with me. I had to behave and have good table manners and things like that. And And he was really a teacher rather than a playmate.
He had been a teacher before he became a lawyer.
Yes, yeah. He'd always been before he was. And he became a lawyer with, he never went to law school or anything. They just studied at night, passed the law exam mm-hmm. in those days. And then he moved out to South Dakota.
Yeah.
And from there he moved to Montana.
And he acquired this lodge, this property, at about 1900.
1900 yeah. He acquired it. He bought it from a Mr. Gadoon, who was a original landowner here, a homesteader, who incidentally had the house that the Hoigs have next door, although it's not the original one. He lived there. And my grandfather bought this property from him and started the house, and the house was finished in 1906.
And it's a grand old log lodge, six bedrooms.
A grand old log lodge.
Faces on the lake.
Yes.
And I just learned today that the celebrated photographer Ansel Adams.
Yes, took that view from my beach.
Took the view of Lake McDonald, the famous photograph
from my beach.
Of it,
uh-huh.
From the beach uh-huh. in front of the house uh-huh. that Senator Walsh
right.
built.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And
about when would that have been, in the 50s?
Must have been while I was gone, or I would have remembered it,
yeah.
and I really can't tell you. Probably in the 50s,
yeah.
yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm not sure exactly when he became so famous, but I was overseas at the time.
Now, Senator Walsh spent some of his summers here.
Always,
beginning
yes.
in 1906, probably, until virtually his death.
Right, right. Always.
Now,
and he always brought up his secretary and his aide and whoever else was on his staff. And at that time, his law partner was Mr. Nolan from Helena.
Colonel C.B. Nolan.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And he was dead when I remember. He was gone.
Mm-hmm.
But my Mrs. Nolan, I called her Auntie Nolan, always stayed at our house down here.
Mm-hmm.
And she had the Clack cabin, what now belongs to the Clacks. And she always
That's
lent.
H. Earl Clack, the oil company man?
Yes,
yeah.
right. Uh-huh. The one, but they didn't buy it till, probably in the, it was after Annie Nolan died, so I would say probably early 30s.
Mm-hmm.
They bought that property from her estate.
I see.
And my mother wanted my grandfather to buy it, but he didn't buy it.
Oh,
and
that's a story. You should.
Well, yes. Anyway. He didn't get it, and we needed it for overflow because we were already full down at the big cabin. And my grandfather used to use the alcove above on the balcony. We had curtains across in those days, and I can remember him shaving up there with the pitcher and the ewer and with the pitcher and the basin,
yeah.
shaving up there. I
yeah.
can remember him. So,
you spent time here on Lake McDonald while he was spending time here in the summer?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. yes. We came every summer that we could come, not when we were in the Philippines, of course, but
sure.
when we were stationed in the States, my mother came. My father didn't come very much, but my mother came and took care of the place and kind of acted as his hostess out here and so on. And that's when Daisy Harriman would come out,
mm-hmm.
you see. And
well, there were probably other notables in addition to her that came and
visited
him there
in the
summer. Oh,
yes, I'm sure, but I don't remember that.
Mm-hmm.
And they never had a guest book, which I'm sorry about.
Well, you showed me the scrapbook here earlier where there are notes to your grandfather from William Jennings Bryan.
Oh, yes, I know.
And Franklin D. Roosevelt and Senator W.A. Clark and Herbert Hoover, I think.
Yes, Herbert Hoover was in there.
Yeah.
They were everybody from... say 1924 or 25 on up until he died,
Now, he died in 1933,
uh-huh.
but the Going to the Sun Highway was finished in 1932.
No, 33.
Oh, was
it was
33?
The dedication.
Okay, so
after
he never
died,
was able to travel.
He never saw it.
Okay.
No, he never
I would
saw
think
it.
He might have had a hand in the construction of that.
Well, he probably did, or in pushing it to
yes,
be
I
constructed.
Think, yeah.
I'm sure he did. And
yeah.
we were asked to the opening. I remember that.
Yeah.
And I was asked to the centennial.
Yeah.
And I
were you present at the opening of it?
I must have been, but I don't
just
remember.
Just don't have a clear recollection
yeah.
of it.
But
I talked to someone who was there a few years ago, and he said his recollection was that there were Indians in full regalia, quite
uh-huh.
a number of them.
Uh-huh.
And they were impressive to him as a young man at the time.
Oh, could be. Well, I know at my grandfather's funeral, he was an honorary Indian chief. That's what the headdress is from down there. And at his funeral, it's all of it from the back of the cathedral in Helena. And all of it's these people, you know, there. And in it, one Indian chief with the headdress.
Huh.
And you can see it right on the picture. And it's was one of the ones that was published in Jean Bacchus's Memories of Helena. And I can remember, well, he was a great fisherman. And he fished a lot. But I don't remember him as going swimming or anything like
yeah.
that much.
But he fished on McDonald Creek, I suppose?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
All around.
Yeah.
And those days, we used to catch horses over to Trout Lake, and I can remember going over to Trout Lake with him on the horseback. And we used, of course, go to Sperry, but always on horseback. We never yeah. hiked huh. as such. He didn't either. He went on horseback.
He preferred to travel on horseback.
Yeah. And
wasn't there some incident here involving a bear?
Oh, yes, there surely was. That's the bear that's on the wall down there.
His hide's on the wall down there.
Yeah,
right.
I've got it on the wall. And that happened when maybe I was 6 or 7. And here is higher, as you understand, here in the back is higher than the lodge is lower.
Down nearer the lake.
Yes, and it goes up. And the cook came in and said, oh, there's a bear, Sender. There's a bear in the backyard. So he went out, and he had a gun, which you shouldn't have had in those days in the park. Still shouldn't, but in those days. And what happened was he shot in the air just to scare the bear away. He couldn't see. It was dark. And he just went out and shot it out of the back door up in the air. And the next morning, the cook came in and said, Sender, you killed that bear. He said, don't be ridiculous. Couldn't have killed that bear. It was dark out, and I wasn't aiming at the bear. And said, well, the bear is dead in the backyard. So it was. It was dead up here, up higher. And he hadn't aimed high enough. And anyhow, I was very interested in the skinning of the bear. They strung it up and yeah. skinned it. And then everybody said, well, what should we say to Ellen so she won't let this be known about the bear, because you're not allowed to have guns in the park and so on. So they didn't say anything, thought it was better just to ignore it and I'd forget it. And I forgot it for a whole year until the legislature met down in Helena. And at that point, I proceeded to tell the whole legislature how my grandfather had killed a bear in National Park. I think he could have killed me right on the spot.
Well, frankly, yeah. if he'd have shot straight in the air.
Yes, he thought he had.
Well, I wonder if he didn't.
Well, I don't know. That's a story in any case. That's what I was told long ago. Long ago and far away.
No, he died en route to Washington, D.C.,
yes,
and
did.
I want to ask you about that, but certainly you'd have been 13 years old. He lay in state.
Oh,
in
yes.
the U.S. Capitol building, and
oh, yes.
Franklin D. Roosevelt may have even
yes,
said a few
words. Yes, he did,
words.
And Roosevelt was gave the eulogy at the funeral.
You must have some recollection of that.
Yes, I do. That I remember perfectly, because...
Well, tell about that.
We got word, my dad was stationed in Norfolk, Virginia at the Naval Operating Base, and we got word about, in the middle of the night, that he had died on the train in North Carolina. And so immediately my mother took my sister and myself and my father, and we drove to Washington, D.C. And we got to Washington, D.C. before the train got in with his body. And mother went to the Senate office building right away to for his files, or to look, see if everything was all right. And it was shambles. Somebody had just looted the office completely. And nothing was left of whatever he was investigating at the moment. And I would assume that the Library of Congress would have that information as to what he was looking into. But it was a...
How did your mother happen to go to his office?
I don't know whether she had a funny feeling or what. I don't know, or whether it was to get something.
But
I don't remember.
Because his office was still a functioning office,
Oh, yeah.
If it was ransacked, it would have had to have been...
that night.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, after they closed it up and before the train got in.
Which seems like an incredible coincidence.
Right, and that's why my father was always leery about what the investigation was and why that had happened. All those papers had disappeared.
Well, now I've read recently that Senator Walsh had some important files that pertained to some investigation he had done of the aluminum industry.
It might have been aluminum or steel.
It was related to U.S. steel.
In my mind, it had something to do with Pennsylvania somehow.
Okay, and those files never got from his office to the Justice Department.
Never did.
Where the Justice Department, even in his after his death, might have been able to resume this investigation.
Never, they just disappeared.
So there could have been some connection between that and the ransacking of his office.
And the fact, that my father always thought he'd been murdered.
Well, maybe now would be a good time to explain that, but before you do, we need to set that up, because your grandfather had been a widower for 15 or 16 years.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then when he was over 70, I think 72 or 73.
73, uh-huh.
He married this woman in Cuba who was much younger than
him. Oh, yeah, she was in her 40s.
And maybe you could just tell us
that
story.
I don't really know even how he met her. I never saw her before. My mother didn't know her. And all of a sudden, she was a very wealthy, when I say wealthy, I think she had lost whatever wealth she had. She had been married to a sugar baron, and the name was De Peremont. No, I've got that wrong. I have to think about that. Anyway, she was a widow, and her villa in Havana became the Tropicana nightclub in Cuba, and nobody knew her. I think it was a complete surprise to my mother that he was marrying her. And she came to Washington, of course. She was on the train with him.
But what happened was she was married in Cuba,
uh-huh.
And there was some kind of unsettled political
thing going on
in Cuba.
I'm not sure. Yes, it was...
she was connected to...
To whoever the dictator was at the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they were trying to get him out.
They were trying to get him out of power.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And whether they... I don't know.
Another faction in Cuba was trying to get him out of power.
That's right.
She was close to him. So your grandfather and she were married in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I remember some story or other about how they had arranged to be married on one date. Then they decided to move that up a couple of days because Senator Walsh wanted to make sure he got back to Washington.
That's right. In time for the inauguration.
Attorney General. And to begin with, the president of Cuba was going to attend her wedding.
And then he didn't show.
Then he wasn't able to make it because he said that the change in date had made it possible for him to make it within his schedule. Anyway, for whatever reason, he wasn't there. They were married, and then they quickly flew
to Miami.
To Miami, where he visited Anton Cermak,
mm-hmm.
the mayor of Chicago, who had been wounded in the assassination attempt on FDR a few days before.
That's right. Uh-huh.
And who he knew. And then he went back to get on the train to go up to Washington, D.C., where he would have been sworn in two or three days later,
mm-hmm.
as Attorney General.
That's right.
And then, according to the story, and I don't know whether this fits in with your father's analysis or not, but according to the story, he complained of indigestion and some chest pains as they were getting on the train. And then sometime after they left Miami, somewhere across North Carolina, according to this woman he married,
mm-hmm.
she said she was awakened in the night. She looked across and saw that he wasn't in his berth. Then she was startled to see him lying on the floor. She screamed. They found a physician on the train who came in and examined him and found him dead. And there wasn't ever an autopsy done.
No, my mother wouldn't allow an autopsy. Why, I don't know.
And the physician at the scene said, I think the death certificate said something like cause of death unknown, but probable some kind of thrombosis or mm-hmm. something or other.
Mm-hmm.
It appeared to the physician involved to be a heart attack.
Well, who knows?
Who knows? But I know your father has a different interpretation.
Yes, my father always thought that he'd been murdered.
Well, what was the basis for your father thinking that?
Well, the very fact that he had never had heart problems or anything like that, and the fact that the office had been ransacked and nobody ever found the files.
Yeah.
And it never came up, even with Roosevelt being a friend and all like that, it never came up at all, this investigation. Like the Teapot Dome was a big scandal. And this never came up, never was investigated.
But I thought you told me your father suspected this.
Well, he suspected the maid that had gotten on the train with them.
Why? What was the basis for that?
Well, I don't think for any reason at all, except that she was sort of foreign, and the fact that...
Wasn't it that she might have been associated with the other faction?
With the other faction in
Cuba?
Oh, yes.
And that they were afraid that Tom Walsh, as the Attorney General in the Roosevelt administration,
right,
might help to keep this
That's
guy
right.
in power
That's right.
in Cuba
right.
that they didn't
help
like?
Help to keep him in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was my father's theory,
yeah.
Now, whether it's true or not. And I have...
Didn't you say your father wrote that all down?
Yes, he did, and I've got it in Houston, and I mean in Tucson, and I never have gotten to get that to you, and I know I promised
Be
it
sure,
to you last year.
Be sure to get that to
year.
Me so we can make that a part of this historical record.
Yes, I can
yeah.
send it to you.
Yeah, I'd like
yeah,
to see
I'll
it.
I'll send it to you, and what I have in the way of other things on that death.
Yeah.
And I know we all went to the funeral, and I remember in those days... widows and anybody really connected with the person wore the long black veils over their clothes, and my mother had one on, and Mina, the wife, had one on, and Mina kept fainting dead away and things like that, and I remember Mrs. Roosevelt walked over and lifted my mother's veil and kissed her and said she was so sorry and everything like that. And ever after that, Mrs. Roosevelt was very nice to my mother, always. And Mother Roosevelt lent his car to my mother to carry my grandfather out here. And all along the way, when they'd stop at railroad stations and everything, there was a big turnout to, you know, to wish him well and her well and all.
Yeah.
But Mina didn't come. She wasn't indisposed, the widow. And she went back to Cuba, and we never heard from her again. At least I never heard from her.
And you told me once, too, that your father had a prized Charles M. Russell painting that she took back to Cuba with her?
Oh, yes. His will was invalid because his widow was not mentioned. And in Montana, that was the law then. And so she got half of what he had. And mother needed the apartment in Washington because my dad was in the Navy and he was going to sea, and she'd stay there when he was at sea. And so she gave the Charlie Russell painting that my grandfather had to Mina, and she took the apartment. Well, years later, or last year, a couple of years ago, I got a letter from a lawyer in Atlanta, Georgia, asking me if I knew where that painting was. And I don't even remember what it looked like, so I can't tell. I had to write it back, said I have no idea, but I'm sure she sold it. Must be in somebody's collection.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have no idea even what it looked like.
Mm-hmm. But did you go then, so Franklin D. Roosevelt
mm-hmm.
lent your mother uh-huh. a car to transport your father's body back
right.
to,
uh-huh. Here
did
to
you
Helena.
Go with them? Did you go back to Helena for
no,
the funeral?
No, I didn't. I went
see.
Back to Norfolk, Virginia.
With your dad?
With my father,
yeah.
Yes. I was in school and all like that.
And
no, my mother was...
Then there was
And your grandmother went.
Oh.
Auntie Irene.
She went?
She went back with my mother on the train.
Oh,
to,
really?
Uh-huh, from Washington, D.C. to okay. Helena.
And there was a great funeral in Helena for
yes,
Tom
Yes, it
Walsh,
was. In the cathedral was
yeah.
full
yeah.
In Helena.
Have
yeah.
you visited his gravesite in Helena?
Oh, sure.
It's very humble. I mean, there isn't anything ostentatious about it at all. It's just a...
No, but it really was to my grandmother. That original stone was for my grandmother.
I see.
Not my grandfather.
Yeah.
But anyway, my grandfather's buried there. Now my mother is buried there, and the fellow that ran away with the circus is buried there. But I'm upset with that Helena one because it's the Catholic cemetery, and they don't keep it up well. It's overgrown, and I've gone down there and gotten a nursery to go in and clean it up and everything like that, but I can't do that all the time. I mean, compared to this one in Kalispell, that one in Helena is a mess.
Your grandfather was Irish and a very devout Catholic.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Matter of fact, his father, they left Ireland in about 1840 and went up the St. Lawrence River and went down into Wisconsin. And the reason that they didn't go into New York was because they could get work in the lumber camps and stuff like that. And Felix, the father, my grandfather's father, became the postmaster of the little village where they, Two Rivers, Wisconsin. And then he brought up all those other people.
Hmm.
And they came from Armagh, A-R-M-A-U-G-H, Armagh, in Ireland, which is in North Ireland, actually. It's up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been back there, but I never did go and look up anything. Cause,
mm-hmm.
And he was a weaver, the grandfather of the in Ireland. And goodness, the things that people accomplish, huh? And
now, Ellen, I want to before we conclude our interview, I want to know a little bit more about you. Your father died, as I recall, as a captain.
Yes.
In the Navy, right on the outbreak of World War II.
So that's right. Yes, he died
really
in 1941.
Mm-hmm. And but your mother outlived him by many years.
Oh yes. Uh-huh.
In fact, she didn't die until maybe the 1980s.
Right.
Yeah.
She died in 79.
1979.
Yeah,
her name was Genevieve.
She was 88, yeah.
And she was Tom Walsh's only daughter?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And she had two daughters, one of whom was your mother.
That's right.
And you've been...
No, I mean, my mother had two daughters. One was my sister.
That's what I meant. Yeah, that's
one
I meant.
Was my sister.
Yeah, that's what I meant. And so this property has been in your family since 1900.
That's right, over 100 years.
And
uh-huh.
what did you do? Went to college in the 30s, or?
Yeah, I went to Mount Holyoke in Massachusetts, and I got out in 1941. And my mother, during World War II, went to work for the Office of Economic Warfare. She was one of those analysts of the economic warfare. And particularly on Italy, she did a lot of work on Italy as to what to expect that the Nazis didn't walk off with.
Yeah.
And anyhow, she worked until the war was over. And then when the war was over, she moved out back to Helena.
Oh, I see. So your mother lived in Helena for many years.
Oh, yes.
I see.
Now, our big home in Helena that my grandfather had belongs to a physician, but I tell you who had it. Did you know Steve and Judy Browning?
Yes, very well.
Well, okay, they lived in my grandfather's house.
Okay.
They bought that.
Well, I've been there, but I didn't know that.
Yeah, that belonged to him, and he built that one. And an old Victorian, beautiful home.
What I'm reaching for here, Ellen, was that you had an interesting career. You had a very interesting career.
Oh, yes, me. I've done everything.
You danced with a professional dance group in New York City.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
What was the name of that?
Well, it depended on where we were working. I mean, when I was with the Vaughn Monroe's band, we were at the Commodore, and we were called the Commodorables. And we had beautiful costumes, and we had beautiful, you know, and Vaughn Monroe was one of the big band people. And he was delightful. And then I was went on the road with the Copa show and jumped into the Copacabana.
Yeah.
Jumped into that show and went on the road with that show. And then when I came back from there, I went into the Latin Quarter, which was Barbara Walters' father was my boss. And then I got married.
The Latin Quarter was a club.
Yes.
In New York City.
Yes. Uh-huh, a nightclub. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
On Times Square, actually.
Yeah.
And Vaughn Monroe's was at the Commodore Hotel.
Were there ever any interesting people who came to any of those shows that you could identify or anything?
Oh, that worked at them, you mean?
No, that were there, like...
Oh, no, because we weren't allowed to...
When you think of that industry during that period, you think of gangsters and things like that.
Well, the Copa was owned by the Mafia, certainly. Certainly it was.
Did you ever have any, did you ever see any of those guys around, or would you have known?
No. And we weren't allowed to fraternize with the audience, the public. I mean, we could never go in the room and sit, say, at one of the tables or anything, because they get you on soliciting then, you see.
Sure.
And so that these were clubs with their would lose their license if the girls went out in the front. But sometimes somebody would send you a note backstage or something like that. And when Jim was courting me, he used to sit back by the stage door and wait for me to come out. And at the Latin Quarter, the waiters knew him, and sometimes they'd let him sit at a table way in the back so that nobody would see him. Well, then I went to Norfolk, Virginia with Jim. And
you also did some work for magazines, fashion magazines?
Oh, yes, but all during that time that I was working in New York, from 1941 to 45 when I got married. And then.
And so your pictures are in Mademoiselle and Vogue and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
From 41 to 45. If you come to Tucson, I'll show them to you. And then.
And Jim was a Navy officer during World War II.
Yes, uh-huh. And then we were stationed in Norfolk, Virginia, and I went to work as a school teacher.
What did you teach?
I taught math and physical geography to the eighth grade. I hated it. I'd rather sell in the 10-cent store than teach school, I can tell you. Oh, terrible. I had, 42 kids in your class and you're changing all the time. No, thank you. Anyway, then Jim went overseas and I went to work at the embassy, the American embassy in Jeddah, and I was a code clerk. And I had a security...
Now, Jeddah is in Saudi Arabia?
Huh?
Jeddah
in Saudi Arabia,
yeah.
In Jeddah. And then I went up to... We went to Lebanon, and I used to sell clothes and worked for a Madame Jenny there who imported everything from France, some clothes. And we went down and sold clothes to Princess Farida in Egypt. And then...
Did you meet her?
No, I didn't meet her. I just showed her clothes. No.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, I saw her.
Jim worked for the Mobil Oil Company?
Yes, he was the Mobil Oil by that time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then we went to the Congo. No, then we went to Egypt, and I didn't work in Egypt, just charity work and stuff. But then went to the Congo, and I worked for National Catholic Welfare Council. Did the French translating for a priest that came in from the States.
Do you speak French?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well... When we went to Beirut, I'd had a lot of French in college, and see, their language is Arabic and French, and I had a lady that came to the house from 10 in the morning until about 3 in the afternoon, and we read the newspapers, and we had lunch, and we went for the kids at school and all, and after 6 months, I could get along okay. And then Egypt, of course, was English again. Then went to the Belgian Congo. It was all French again. And my kids were in school in French. And then all hell broke loose in the Congo, and I couldn't keep the kids. It was too dangerous, and I sent the girl to Switzerland, and the boy came home to the States. And then went to Morocco. I didn't do anything in Morocco except do charity things. And then I went to Mexico, and in Mexico you can't work unless you have a work permit. But then when Jim retired and we went to Houston, I went to work first for Giddings, who was a portrait photographer. Sold his wedding business photographs. And then that parlayed into, I became head of the wedding business for Sackowitz, which was a big department store chain in Texas. And then Jim retired and we went to California, and I ran the boutique for Conrad Hilton in the Hilton Hotel. And then went to work for a bridal company there. And then from there went to May Company, which you've probably heard of May Company, the big department store chain. And I went in the fine jewelry department there. And then I quit.
Now, I think you told me...
Now I'm getting paid $100 to talk.
I think you told me that you became acquainted with Laura Bush or Barbara
Bush.
Oh,
yeah. Well, I've met five first ladies. The first one was Mrs. Coolidge that I knocked off her feet. And the second one was Mrs. Roosevelt, who was so nice to my mother and everything. And the third one was Lady Bird Johnson that came backstage at a wedding in Houston when I was working. And the fourth one was Laura Bush. Oh, the fifth one was Mamie Eisenhower. And I met her before she was Mrs. President. She was the godmother, and he was the general, was the godfather when he was head of Columbia University. And a friend of mine had a baby, and they had been best friends, her mother and Mamie. And so Mamie was the godmother, and I met her at the christening.
Huh.
So that's it.
But was Eisenhower at the christening as well?
Huh?
Was Ike at the
yes,
christening?
Yes, she
well?
Was there. Jim remembered speaking to Ike, and he says, Ike said to him, "It sure is hot today." And Jim says, "Yeah, it sure is hot today." And that was the end of their conversation. He always claimed he spoke to Eisenhower.
Yeah, well, you've lived a remarkable life, and this place here on Lake McDonald has really been the closest thing you've had to a permanent home.
It's the only permanent home I've ever had, that house down there.
Yeah.
I never had one before. We were always living in quarters or in apartments or changing all the time and everything, and this is the only thing I ever had. Now I bought a home in Tucson, Arizona, and so that's now where I have all my goodies. Like my files and all like that.
And this interview is taking place on September 2nd?
4th.
September 4th, 2010.
I thought it's the 3rd. I don't know. 4th? Is it really?
September 4th, 2010.
2010, yeah.
So you're 90 years old.
I'm 90 years old, yeah.
And you've probably got close to 80 or more years of memories of
in
this Shemala, place.
Inshallah, as they say in Arabic, God willing.
Well, it's wonderful to visit with you, Ellen.
Oh,
do you have anything
you.
More you'd like to say?
I've had a good time. I had a wonderful life.
Well.
And John will attest to it. I've known him since he was a little boy.
Since he was wearing three-cornered seat covers.
Yeah, right. Well, I can't think of anything else to tell you. If I could think of it, I would. But
well, thank you. You
long ago, I can tell you. Some places I didn't like, of course, but most places I loved that I lived in.
Yeah.
I loved Lebanon. I liked Saudi Arabia. Egypt, all right. Congo, I couldn't stand. Morocco's one of the most beautiful places I ever lived in my life. And I loved Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, you've lived a fascinating life.
Really
there's
good time,
no question about that.
Well, it's been fun.